We're glad you're joining us here at Common Thread Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts. So we've got this big thing coming up in our community in just 2 weeks, Tuesday, October 13th at 7 p.m. on Zoom. It's the public launch of One Wake, our community of communities. Our purpose is to build the power of relationship so that together we can mitigate pain for people and families here in Wake County. Now, we've been 3 years getting ready, and that Tuesday evening, it's going to be our coming out party. 2,000 of us will be on that Zoom call with candidates and officials from the county commission, from the city council, and from the school board. And we'll be asking them to start a public relationship with us and to make commitments to work on three areas along with us. We asked 3,300 people what pain they feel living in Wake County. And after that, we've determined that we're going to be asking our elected officials, our decision makers, to work with us on affordable housing, jobs, and a preparation pipeline for good jobs, and public education. Now, we've been meeting with candidates in preparation for that meeting, and they are agreeing to come. And they're agreeing to come because each of our communities has committed to each other that we would have X number of people there on the Zoom. The total of all of our commitments is around 2,000, and for that, decision makers are willing to show up. So I nudged up our common thread commitment. I made it pretty aggressive. The team initially suggested 100 people for our commitment, but I really want you to be there. So I nudged it up to 150. I really want you to see this. I want you to see how a community of communities has the potential to be here 50 years from now, long after we are gone, still be here building on the power of relationship to change the systems that cause the pain in our county, pain that hasn't even happened yet. Because 50 years ago, organizations just like ours started, and they are still there working on behalf of their communities. I want you to see us together begin living out Jesus' teaching about the kingdom of God, making things on earth as they are in heaven. I want you to see us begin putting feet to the concept of Tikkun Olam, being healers of the world, repairing what is broken. I want you to see us begin moving our world from what it is to what it could be. What I really want you to see is healthy religion. All the tools and practices we do together, they make us better people so that together we can build a better world. And I want you to see us take the first step here in Wake County. Also, let's be honest, I don't want to be embarrassed. So please, do register. Go over there right now. If you're watching live, go to onewake.org/launch. And if you're watching later, do it right then, right now. onewake.org/launch. Also, in the drop-down menu, make sure that you click Common Thread because we do want to be counted. So a second strategy that we're using to get our agenda taken seriously is we've been running this nonpartisan Get Out the Vote campaign. If you go to our website, commonthreadchurch.org/GOTV, Get Out the Vote. Everything you need to know about voting safely in Wake County this year, you can find it right there on the site. So again, I really hope that you'll be there. Please register right now. And if there are two folks watching it right now, register two folks. And if you have teenagers who could be there on that Tuesday night, register them. Just think 50 years down the line. Let them get this into their heads. This is how we can be shapers of a better world. If you've got other friends, invite them to come, family members. Let them see this thing happen. onewake.org/launch. onewake.org/launch. And again, be sure, select Common Thread in the drop-down menu. We do want to be counted. Okay. So tell me what you hate about religion. I've been asking a lot of people that. I told you Jared's response last week. I hate religion, he said, because it divides people. Well, today, the same theme, but somebody else's story, this time Julie Thompson. Here's what I hate, Doug. I hate how you preacher guys you treat the rest of us like a notch in your belt. You folks who are in the inside of the religion club, you've got an agenda, and your agenda is to get me into your club, and I can smell it a mile off. God may have a wonderful plan for your life, but we know for sure that we do. Our plan is to get you saved, get your butt in a seat, get you volunteering for the team, and get you paying for this thing. And she said, you could just feel the pressure that goes with that. And so she said, when I came here to Common Thread, it was North Raleigh Community Church when she came, she said, I sat in the back for a year. I had my arms crossed, and I was just waiting for you or some of your religious people to just try and come sell me some program. I had 1 foot out the door from the day that I came. But you didn't. And now I really do care about our community. I care that we are moving forward and making this a better, healthier religion. Now she said, there must have been some wisp of hope in me because I did keep coming back. And I mean, why would I do that? So I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that we can fix what is broken in our religion. And I'm hoping that we can make it more connecting and less choosing up teams. Well, that's not an uncommon sentiment. I said last week, when we break religion, it happens. It's not the end of the world. Through all of history, we've done it so many times. It happens. Sure it does. But when we do, it is our tradition and it is our duty to fix it, to wade in and to start doing the hard work to repair what we have broken. Well, today we continue looking at how. When religion gets broken and divides people, how do we fix it? Well, I said last week, the first stop on the fixing religion journey is always to examine the stories that we tell ourselves. And one of our religion's core stories is about our afterlife. That's kind of religion's job, to hammer out meaning-making stories that we find ourselves in and that we live in, stories that point us toward better lives and toward a better world. And when our religion is healthy, that is exactly what our stories do. They point us to better lives. But when religion is not healthy, they don't. And our religion has become a byword for dividing people. And when we see that, it's a pretty good bet that our core meaning-making stories have gone wrong. So what went wrong? Last week, I started with our afterlife story. And I started that by looking at Jesus' story about the sheep and the goats. And if you missed, you can have a listen online. But here's the thing, I said, when our religious story tells us that we will be divided up at the end and we'll be divided for all of eternity, we can't but start dividing ourselves up now. So what Julie said, it happens. I know it's true. Preachers do feel pressure. They usually sign up to help a community grow and to heal and to transform. But the pressure in the system shoehorns them into a sales job where they're selling Jesus or selling the prayer. Or worse, if you can't sell it to people, we have to draw clear lines to protect ourselves, the good people, from those who wouldn't buy the program, the bad people. Well, I suggested last week, that story that puts that pressure into the system, that afterlife story, we got it wrong. Now, there are historically understandable reasons why we got it wrong, but we got it wrong. What we think Jesus meant, telling a story about sheep and goats, and what Jesus did mean, not the same. Well, last week I just touched on the why and the how of the we got it wrong statement, and after the live stream there were a few folks here, and I asked them, so what do you think? Do you think we need to give the history and the background and the context for saying we got our afterlife story wrong? And I ask that because it's going to take several words, many of them, and we only get so many words each Sunday, so shall we take the time, or could I just move on? And then I said, I wrote a whole book just to help folks catch up, and they were very nice about it. But in essence, what they said was, so Doug, thank you for all your hard work writing that book. But we're not going to read it. It's like 200 pages. Oh, so you better give the background. Well, nothing if not helpful. So one more week on stories, and then next week a more practical approach to fixing a religion that divides us. So in the book, I go through a whole bunch of texts that we think are about the afterlife. In essence, what I say is this: we know stuff now that we didn't know when we were using those texts to stitch together a story about our afterlife. What we know now, we found in a bunch of caves between 1946 and about 1956. Because in those caves were a bunch of scrolls that were preserved in a bunch of pots, and there in the dry climate of the Middle East, they had lasted since the Qumran community, which was an apocalyptic Jewish community from about the time of and right after Jesus. And those scrolls, we call them the Dead Sea Scrolls, they acted like a Rosetta Stone to help us understand all those texts with all of that weird, incomprehensible, mysterious language. What we thought were texts about the afterlife, it turns out, the folks who wrote them were not writing about the end of their lives. They weren't writing about the end of time. They weren't writing about the end of the cosmos. They were writing about the end of their current era of suffering. Those texts were very right here, right now texts. They were not in the sweet by and by texts. So here's the history part. Because of geography, throughout history, Jewish people have been constantly under the heel of some dominant invading army. And their resources, their foodstuffs, their wealth, even their survival rations were being siphoned back to some empire and starving them. So often, on a recurring basis, they suffered a loss of self-determination. They had a parade of collaborating puppet governments. People were longing for freedom, longing to feed their children. And it happened again and again, century after century. And over time, we learned from the scrolls, they developed a story and a language. The story was hope. The divine will win out in the end. Goodness will prevail in the end. We will be free again. Hold on to hope. They had a story. The second, they had a language. Now, the language was purposely weird. It was the language of trumpets and bowls and troubles and dragons and harlots and sheep and goats and wheat and weeds and hell and Gehenna. Language that was purposely obscured so that they could use it to talk about hope, to talk about their aspirations for freedom, their aspirations for self-determination. It was a language for encouraging one another without getting their heads chopped off. It would hardly do when you're under foreign occupation to stand up on a street corner and say out loud, "Hey, folks, hold on to hope because our God will eventually send these damn Assyrians back to wherever they came from." No. You say that? Them's head-chopping words. So the scrolls gave us an interpretive lens for all of those weird words and all of those weird images, and they showed us that theirs was a very here-and-now story. Those were very here-and-now texts. God will redeem what is broken soon and very soon, right here, on this very land that we spend our days walking. The dragon will be slain right here. The trumpets will blow right here. We will be free in our lifetimes. So hold on to hope. So that was going on. And then history. A sect of Judaism, we now call it Christianity, moved west. And when they did, they left the Hebrew world and they entered the Greco-Roman world. And when they did that, they left a material world, a world of things and stuff and space, the tangible world that we touch and feel. They left a material world that was shot through with divine breath, shot through with divine spirit, pulsating with divine presence. And they arrived in a world, Plato's world, in which the material world was corrupt. The material world was at best derivative of the real world somewhere else. The best world, the good world, the uncorrupted world was somewhere far away in the non-material, non-physical realm. They called it the realm of forms. But here, corrupt. So consequently, when Western Christians read those weird, opaque, hidden language texts, their Western minds just naturally assumed those texts must be talking about the end of the material world, because every good Greco-Roman knew that the material world was not made of divine breath. Again, it was corrupt and derivative. So, rather than hope in the redemption of material things, about the 4th century, we started shifting our hope to our eventual escape from this material world. The day will come when we ascend to the non-material world of forms, which we co-opted and started thinking of as the afterlife. Now, again, that was not the case for the people who wrote those texts on which we begin to build that story. They fully expected that since divine reality is embedded right here in the material world, anything that goes wrong, anything that gets broken, well, we will, of course, join God in this great project of fixing it, repairing the world. It will be us joining with the divine to bring forth that divine beauty that is resonant in every broken thing and restore it to its original shine. We would never, in that story, abandon this world for some great escape off to heaven. No. We have what we need, and we have it right here, because this material world is our true home. Okay? That's all well and good, but Christians did make that westward journey. And 1,600 years later, most of us learned a religious story founded on a great escape afterlife, a great getting up morning. It's a story that would have been totally unheard of to Jesus or to Paul or to those who wrote the text that we reference when we tell that story. So now, here we are this many years later. Now, we can forgive those who lost our origin story, because they did move from an Eastern, Hebrew, divine in everything world, and they did arrive in a Western, Greco-Roman, divine out there somewhere world. And after they made that move, well, it just did make sense to modify the story in the way that they did. But here's the thing, now we know better. Now we have the scrolls. We know that we lost a precious story. And we know that we picked up a skewed one. And we can see how this skewed story that we picked up, how it sits down inside of us and how it kicks up, dividing us from each other, instincts. Now we know that our lost story used to create connecting us to one another, instincts. And so now we know we got it wrong. Now that's tough, because 1,600 years is a long time to be telling the story one way, and people don't like rethinking stories that are that big as that one. Another thing our skewed story has done is it often puts us on the wrong side of protecting the environment. Because if the world is corrupted and it's going to burn, why should we make repairing the world a priority? Also, our skewed story often puts us on the wrong side of social justice, because we are so focused on getting people to heaven. How much energy or time do we have to make sure that everyone has clean water, to make sure that everyone has economic opportunity? Our skewed afterlife story, it's harming us. And as we're talking about in this lesson today, it is one of the driving factors in this long-term habit that we seem to have of reverting back to us versus them, dividing us one from another. Because as we've said, stories create instincts. And this afterlife story, it creates some doozies. So, it's no wonder that preachers get pressured into selling. If this world is not that big a deal, we better get people into the next one. and we better protect each other from outsiders who might keep us from getting there. And even if, as is the case for many of us, even if we don't carry that story around in our heads, we live in the West. And that story is in the air that we breathe. It's in the water that we drink. We are either being influenced by that story or we are being influenced by fighting against that story. And most of the time, we don't even know that it's the story that is driving all that energy. So, again, to fix our broken religion, our first stop is those deep stories that we tell ourselves. Now, if you grew up in church and you never heard any of the stuff that I just said about the scrolls, I bet you have questions. You've probably got objections. I bet there are Bible verses coming up in your mind, sermons that you've heard, funerals that you've been to. And I bet that because it happened to me. It was very disorienting for me to run into Jewish apocalyptic literature and the Dead Sea Scrolls because at that point I had 40 years being weaned on that afterlife story. And it was deeply lodged in my psyche. So if that's you, I get it. But here's the thing. Yeah, it's 200 pages. And if I was writing it today, I'd make it shorter. But the book does give detail on how Western religion shoehorned Eastern texts into a Western worldview. And the thing is, it worked okay for a long time, but now it's not just not working okay. Now it's killing us. And the tragedy is, as we'll see a little bit more in the practical parts next week, we have a really beautiful story. We've got a story that can inspire us to do so much more than just dividing up teams and then hanging on for the afterlife. Those times that we've accessed our better story, we have overcome fear and we have been inspired to change the world. We've approached life and we've approached God and we've approached the spiritual journey, venerating all that is in this earth. This is a God-breathed world, a God-permeated world. That bigger reality that we call the divine, it's right here in every rock and every tree, every atom and every molecule. It's present in the smell of earth. It's present in the touch of our babies. It's present for anyone who has eyes that see and ears that hear. The divine is shot through the material world, through our bodies and our food and our sleep and our sex. It's shot through community and our money and business and our schools. The very institutions that are failing us right now carry the divine light. So when things go wrong, and they sure do go wrong, our story, the story that Jesus was intimately familiar with, the story that Paul was intimately familiar with, our story tells us don't abandon them. Don't escape into some small, walled-in community of like-minded people who are holding on for the exit home. No, dig in and repair the world. Heal it. Fix it. Become participants with divine light and set about the work of redeeming and rescuing whatever has been lost. This is why I so want you to come to the One Wake launch. Because when the night is dark, and oh my God, is it dark these days, our story tells us to find the light, to uncover that light, and to shine it into the darkness. We don't wait for the world to burn. We join the divine and become agents of healing it. We discern the light and we shine it into our own souls and into our own homes and onto our jobs and into our schools and into Wake County. And like our Jewish forebears, there at the crossroads of all those big civilizations that just kept them under their heel for so long, for whom the darkness was so dark, even darker than it is for us right now, we look beyond the immediate to the bigger and the truer and the realer, and we hope. And when we hope, we then encourage one another to hope along with. And when we are encouraged and when we are hoping, we get to work making the world not as it is, but as it can be. And by the way, we meditate. Because when we do that, those gone before tell us, we get past the illusion of separation. We intuit the deeper reality of our connectedness. We awaken to that inner sense that we carry the divine, and it dawns on us, slowly, but it dawns on us, that if I carry the divine, you must too. If rocks and trees are pulsating with the divine, well then, you know what, maybe is the outsider is too. In our story, everything is connected. We are all in continuity, one with another. Our meaning-making story intuited this a long time ago, and it tells us that we are all of a piece, one with the divine, one with our people, one with the earth, and one with those who are not our people. And when we, as a religion, get down to the brass tacks practicality of figuring out how to live that way and how to live out that story, that is a gift that our religion has to give to a world, and it is a gift our world needs. When we find our way again, when we repair what is broken in our own religion, we have a gift to give to a deeply divided society. Immersed in healthy religious practices, we begin to feel deeply the words of Paul, that we, being many, are one body, every one of us a member of every other one of us. We begin to feel deeply what Jesus prayed, that we would be one with the divine, but also experience our oneness with one another in John 17. We begin to feel deeply what philosophers and physicists keep pointing us back to, the interconnectedness of everything. And inspired by a deeper meaning-making narrative, we get to work, uniting, not dividing, gathering, not separating. We challenge evil. Sure we do. But our approach is to use connectedness rather than dividedness. Because in our story, divine reality is present in the institutions of both the Republican and the Democratic Party. Divine reality is present in the institutions of government and education and business and family. And when they get broken, and again, are they broken? They are worth repairing. They are worth nursing back to health. They are worth rethinking and reimagining and rebuilding, because this earth is shot through with goodness. Everything that is in this earth is shot through with goodness and truth and beauty. And when something that is good and true and beautiful gets broken, we don't abandon it, we fix it. Redemption is our way. Ours has always been a story of healing and restoration. It's a good story. It's a beautiful story. And it's a whole lot better story than just hanging on until we die. And so, inner divine, eyes that see and ears that hear, that's our prayer. Seeing a better story that will point us to a deeper reality, a divine presence in everything reality, so that we connect one to another, become better people, and together begin building a better world. Again, that is our prayer. As we follow Jesus, amen. Now, you might realize that I left something unsaid during that lesson. Hey, Doug, if the sheep and goat story isn't about the afterlife, what is it about? And for that, my friends, you're going to have to get the book. All right, so if you would, please prepare your tithes and offerings. And what that has come to mean for us is, if you get to keep your job during this pandemic, if you would go to our website, to the donate button, and remember that a spiritual community is worth investing in. The return on investment is high, and so if you would do that, that would be great. And that being said, what are you thinking about? What is stirring up in your heart? Gene, what are folks saying online there?
So there's two thoughts that are going together. The first one, I just wrote, so where do we find the new stories that once again reconnect us, and how do we tell them? And Sherry Vurke had a comment that said, have those stories not been co-opted by those in power to control those over whom they want to maintain control? So I think those kind of go together.
Yeah. Here's what I didn't get to today, because there are, who knows, maybe I'll get to this. Maybe I'll do a subsequent lesson. I'm not sure. But I had a whole section on religion as social control because social control sounds like a terrible thing, but we kind of want some kind of control on one another. We want to not have people slapping each other in the street. We want to use the tools that we've got, and social pressure is one of those, and religion fits into that very well by saying God wants you to behave in this way or that way, and the this way and that way can actually be helpful. You know, we don't want you to be mean. We don't want you to treat people badly. We want you to be honest in your business dealings. We want you to not cheat, and so do that. And so you can't pay attention and not realize that people in power have used religion as a purpose of social control. That happens. It's not all bad, but it's bad enough that it becomes like water poured into a glass of oil. When that is what we are doing, that oil just floats out. And there is so much more that religion and spirituality can be that when it devolves into only social control, then, a bad thing has happened. We have sold out to a story that's just not big enough. It's not inspiring enough. It's not beautiful enough. So, I don't know. Does that seem to address what Sharia was bringing up?
Yeah, it does.
All right.
So we got a message from Claire Cooper. I think Claire's new, and she says,
it's a pleasure to meet you, and I look forward to seeing your real face one day.
And she says, in my search for a church this year, I've never heard messages like these. I'm impressed.
Damn, those people are good.
I think he's talking about you. Katie Card also followed up with talking about John Dominic Crossan as a top New Testament scholar who writes in a very scholarly depth but has been interviewed on lots of podcasts with really accessible explanations on this very topic.
Yeah. Crossan does that. So does Diana Butler Bass. So does Brian McLaren. In the newcomer Zoom afterwards, I'm going to talk about this whole emerging religious movement that is happening planet-wide that we decided like 20 years ago that we would put our lot in with this new Reformation. And right now what we have is a bunch of authors who are speaking to us about new ideas. What's been harder is to then build an institution on those ideas, because everybody knows, I'll say this again in the newcomer lunch, everybody knows organized religion is the boogeyman. Everybody knows organized religion is a bad thing. And so we thought that for a long time. We knew something was wrong, and we thought it was maybe the organized part. But it wasn't the organized part. It was the narrative around which we organized. Because let me tell you, not being organized, anytime you have more than five people in a room, gets painful. And so the question then becomes, how do you create systems that will then help people live out a more beautiful story? Because we all need to be supported by one another. So that's a little bit of an advertisement for, hey, why don't you come join me in the Zoom right afterwards for newcomers? And you can find the link for that on the website. And that being said, it is 11 o'clock. If you would, put your hand on your heart and remember that we are, every one of us, carriers of the indwelling divine. Love and joy and peace and kindness and goodness are within us because the indwelling breath of God, the Spirit of God, is within us. And if you would, extend your other hand to our city and let's look for opportunities to share what's in us with the people that we live and work and go to school with, looking for opportunities to repair and heal our worlds. Amen. God bless you. You're dismissed. If you've already been to the newcomer lunch, head over to the Zoom. If you haven't been to the newcomer lunch, come and join me, and we'll Zoom together. It'll take me 2 or 3 minutes to come and find you all on Zoom. God bless you. See you next week. If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, commonthreadchurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page for your computer's browser, at the bottom of the page for your phones.